Have you ever had that feeling that something wasn't right? Your body was trying to tell you, your relationships were trying to tell you, maybe even your conscience was trying to tell you, but you kept going anyway. Today's conversation is about why so many high-functioning people ignore the warning signs and what it costs them when they do. Welcome back to the show. Today we're continuing our powerful series with Dr. Carter Check. Dr. Check is a U.S. Army veteran, a clinical chaplain, a healthcare ethicist, professor, and best-selling author of Healing in the Wild. His work focuses on moral health, moral injury, grief, identity, and the hidden struggles people carry long before anyone else notices. In our previous episodes, we've talked about moral injury and what happens when a defining role ends. Today, we're taking that conversation one step further because many of us know when something isn't right. We definitely feel it, but instead of stopping it or stopping, we get busier, we push harder, we keep performing, and eventually the cost catches up with us. So today we're talking about why we ignore those signals and how to start listening before it's too late. So, Dr. Chuck, I think most people listening can relate to this. A lot of people ignore the signs. Can you talk to us a little bit about why that is so common, especially with high achievers or anyone for that matter?
Yeah, thank you, Lisa.
Yeah.
It's good to be back with you.
So
I
good to
think this
see
is a
you.
really, yeah, good to see you as well. You know, there's a version of this story most of us know very personally. You know, you felt something was off, not dramatically wrong, just off. And instead of stopping to find out what it was, we just get busier. We think performing, we think getting busier is gonna, fix that. And you just added another commitment, and you just push toward the next milestone, and you filled the silence with movement. Now, not because you're avoiding it on purpose, but because that is what functioning people do. You just keep going, right? And the problem is that the signal does not disappear because you ignored it. It waits. It waits until your busyness stops. And it tends to get louder the longer it goes unaddressed.
Yeah, that's a fact. That's a fact. I'm just literally thinking of a personal experience of staying busy and wanting to be busy because I didn't want to feel that terrible feeling. It's definitely part of our conditioning. We've been taught to push through, push through, push harder, push through the pain. Yeah, we definitely are not good at paying attention.
And some of it is just, I'd say some of it is familiarity. It's what we've done in the past. It's what we've seen other people do. But it doesn't make it right, you know? When you know something's wrong, but you just keep going anyway, it looks like competence without coherence. So from the outside, everything appears intact. You're showing up, you're delivering, you're leading, sometimes even serving. But internally, that alignment is gone. And the things that used to make sense of meaning have become obligations. And relationships that used to restore you, they've become managed. And if you're a person of faith that used to ground you, it even starts to become performative too. And here's what I want you to definitely hear. These folks aren't hypocrites. They're exhausted people who learned how to function without alignment. And functioning without alignment is one of the most expensive things a person can sustain.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And it's so interesting. So this weekend I was helping out at a it was a vision quest, and there was four women who or three women, sorry, who were in the forest, no food or water for 4 days. And one of them made it through the 4 days, and she came out and she looked great. Like, it looked like she was completely functioning. But when I asked her how she was feeling, she said, "I'm exhausted. I feel so incredibly weak." But on the outside, I couldn't tell what she was fighting with internally. And I found that to be so interesting. I was so intrigued by that because it made me think of myself when I'm struggling internally, that no one around me can feel that or sense that, but I'm the one who's feeling that and sense, and I'm living that and trying to function around everyone else and carry on with what I'm to be doing. And I found that fascinating. Like, we never know what someone is going through.
It's one of those things that some of us are so good at wearing a mask to cover up what we're really feeling. And a lot of high functioning people, a lot of times shame tells them, you don't want to tell somebody about this because they're going to think this about you. And so we'll hold it. And we won't share, we won't recognize what we're dealing with because exhaustion's told us that vulnerability is a weakness. So when we get exhausted, it tries to shame tells us a lot of lies, Lisa. If it can't, if shame can't get you to believe that you shouldn't share your story or what's going on with you because someone will think less of you or think you're weak or think whatever. Shame will get you to hold it with like a sense of good. Like, no, don't share that because you might negatively trigger someone else. So shame's ultimate goal is just to keep you silent, right? Whether shame can convince you that you should hold that and not share it because someone might think off of you, or you should hold that and not share it because it might impact someone else in a bad way. Then shame's won because you're being silent, you're not sharing, you're staying isolated. And then the hope of shame, I think, almost every time is, can I keep this individual isolated long enough to get them lonely? That's when shame can do its best work in an individual. And when I mean best work, I'm not talking about something that's good for you. You show me someone who's lonely, and I'll show you someone who's probably thinking an awful lot about whether they should even be in the world today. Am I worth anything? It might be better if I'm gone because I'm a terrible this or bad at that. I get asked a lot around trauma. What's the difference between post-traumatic stress and moral injury? And I think it's, not to simplify it way too much, but this is kind of simplifying it. Post-traumatic stress says you're not safe. Moral injury says you're no good.
Right. Yeah. I'm just trying to digest that. Explain to us a little more about moral injury again for maybe the folks that missed the last episode. And if you guys missed the last couple episodes, I recommend going back and hearing them because they were incredibly powerful. I think they were just absolutely so inspiring.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So when you think about moral injury, I want you to think about what's that an injury to? Moral injury is not a diagnostic disorder. It's not found in the DSM-5. Now, back in September, there was actually an in, a excerpt or it's sit there alongside religious problems or spiritual problems. And all that says is that spiritual problems or religious problems or moral problems have the ability to be a major stressor in someone's life. Okay. So when you think about moral or morality, I want you to remove the conversation of religion from that. Okay. And this might sound crazy. I'm a clinical chaplain. I'm a Christian chaplain. And we've spent enough time together to know that I don't lead with that in my field because I really work in the context of behavioral medicine as a clinical chaplain. So when I'm introduced to someone who is of the Christian faith, well, then that works for me because we share a like faith. But I can companion the Muslim and the Buddhist and the atheist and the agnostic and anybody because I genuinely don't encounter them with some predetermined journey I think they need to go on. I really want to meet them where they are and walk with them where they feel like they need to go. Now, that doesn't mean as a Christian chaplain, I'm helping a Muslim become a Muslim. I don't know anything about that. What I will do is introduce them to an imam or help connect them with the right resources to help that path. But I'm more concerned with this. What do your support systems look like? Where do you draw your strength from? And can I help that pursuit? And then as a high-risk chaplain, I'm really more concerned with their thoughts around suicide and suicidal ideations. Is life worth living, right? And so when we talk about moral injury, I often talk about moral injury around the context of suicidal ideations and behaviors, because when someone has a fracture in their moral identity, that sense of right and wrong, that sense of belonging and alignment of your beliefs and how you exist within the world, I will tell you, and the data doesn't support this because we haven't had enough data around moral injury, but from my experience over the last 10 years as a high-risk chaplain, okay, the data that I have personally experienced shows me quite plainly that more people take their lives over what we'll say is a moral injury than anything you find in the diagnostic system manual, whether they're anxious or depressed or post-traumatic stress or dealing with sexual trauma. All of those things are real. Do not hear me say that none of that is important. It is. But how do you measure helplessness, hopelessness, worthiness? How do you measure shame? These aren't things that you can see on a X-ray, on an MRI. And a lot of times they're so shame-based that people don't necessarily want to even talk about them. And so it's the unseen wounds that really people have a lot of trouble with. I always say this. It's the losses that don't have funerals that people struggle with the most. Now, moral injury is one of those. But before I get into like the nuts and bolts of moral injury real quick, let me say this. Moral injury is not a sign of a weakness in you. It's actually a highlight of the best part of you. Because if you didn't have morals, you wouldn't be suffering. You wouldn't care. And shame tries to tell you because you're suffering a moral injury that you're a bad person. So what are you talking about? I'm talking about the firefighter who pulled five people out of the house but missed one. They don't think about the five people they got out of the burning building. They think about the one they missed, and now I'm a terrible firefighter because I didn't get the sixth one, right? I'm talking about the police officer who had to take a life in the line of duty, and they killed a kid. Well, the kid was armed. Well, it doesn't matter. It was still a kid. It was a violation of what was right to them, because it doesn't matter if the kid is armed or not. If you kill a kid, that's a violation of what's right to you. That's moral injury. It's a violation of what's right to you. And it's really hard to define because it's subjective. It's connected to the loss you've experienced in trauma. And so I always say this. Loss is as individualistic as your thumbprint. Nobody experiences loss the same way. You could be in the same event, same incident, and you experience it differently, okay? So when people say, I know exactly how you feel, Lisa, as much as I know that's usually coming from a place of empathy or a place of wanting to connect, it's about as false statement as you can say to somebody. You might have experienced a similar loss, but you don't know how they feel. So when we say that, a lot of times the reason people say that is they're saying it out of a place of, I really don't know what to say, so I'm going to say this. Like, time heals all wounds. No, it doesn't. Time doesn't heal all wounds. There are some wounds that are never healed in the sense of, this is over and I'm never going to think about it again. Because healing isn't forgetting. Healing is remembering differently. So one thing I talk about in the framework of moral health, remember, we're stripping religion out of this. Religion should be something that if someone is of theistic faith, this should be a, let's call it an anchor or a pillar within their morality that has the ability to strengthen them. But it's not foundational, because even someone of no faith at all can be moral. So morality is not defined by religion. And in a lot of the literature that you'll read, most of the time, morality is directly connected to religion. But we shouldn't do that. It's very problematic, okay? So let's set religion aside for a second, and let's just talk about moral health. What does it mean to be morally healthy? Because if someone has a moral injury, I would argue that that is an injury to whatever you would personally conceptualize as being morally healthy. Mm-hmm. Now, there would be commonality between me and other people and what that would look like, but there would also be distinct differences. You know, maybe my faith is a part of what makes me morally healthy, but someone that has no faith, that wouldn't be a part of theirs. But what would be a commonality? Moral engagement. Our ability to exist within community and relationships, that's important. As a matter of fact, in all of my research, the number one way to combat isolation and loneliness in someone's life is community and connection, their relationships, right? You show me someone that's disconnected from that, I'll show you someone that's suffering in that area, and they're probably questioning whether they should even exist in the world, right? But here's the one I really want to talk about, because moral imagination. Now, this is our ability to think of a positive future, right? And when certain things happen in your life, your ability to think of something positive in the future can be fractured in a very definite way, right? Like someone that loses a baby as an infant. To connect with them the day that they've lost that child and to try and tell them that one life is going to be better one day and you'll get through this and time heals all wounds and all those types of garbage that most people try to say in those moments because they genuinely want to connect and be there. And let's be honest, the best thing to do is just not say anything and just be present. Just be like, hey, I'm here for you. Whenever you need to talk to me, I'm here. And definitely don't lead with a scripture or some type of anything like that, because you're dismissing where the person is. They're in the middle of their pain. So the best thing to do is sit with people in their pain with presence, because presence is the best medicine, okay? But when you think about that moral imagination being fractured, what someone needs is they need a restoration of that moral imagination. What's a theological way of saying that? They need hope restored, okay? When you are hopeful, when you have hopeful thinking, you can think of a better tomorrow. When that's fractured, you can't think of a better rest of the day, let alone a better 5 years down the road, okay? So one thing that I do with the high-risk veterans that I work with, I use the importance ruler. And the importance ruler is a question that I ask. Now, remember, I'm dealing with veterans who have been flagged high risk for suicide. So in my system, they've either just attempted to die by suicide, or they're meeting the thresholds of the algorithm or with their care providers that everybody's like, hey, pay attention to this one, because this is what they're saying. This is what they're, how they're acting. This is what they're doing. So we have them flagged for 60 or 90 days as a high risk. Okay. When I ask, on a scale of 0 to 10, 0 being not important at all and 10 being the most important thing in the world to you, how important is it for you to live? And the most common answer I get is a 5. Okay? The next most common answer I get is a 0. Now, remember, we're talking about moral imagination. The reason I get a 5 is because their imagination has fractured to the point where 5 is the only thing they can think of. That's as far as they can go. So if I were to come back and say, okay, Lisa, how can I get you to a 10? They can't go there. Their imagination doesn't have the ability. Their ability to be hopeful cannot extend to a 10. So I don't go there, right? Because if you were a fixer, if you were trying to fix them or treat them, that's where you want them, right? You want them to improve. My question is different. I say, help me understand why you're not a 1. And I shut up. Because now they have the ability within their fractured imagination to give me the differentiation between a 5, which was their max, and a 1, which is a lower baseline, right? So why aren't you a 1? Now, whether they say, You know, it's a promise I made to my grandmother that I wouldn't kill myself, or I didn't want to see my daughter walk down the aisle with someone else, or I got a service dog, or I started collecting rocks, or I started attending a church service. It doesn't matter what that is. Whatever comes out of their mouth, that is the reason they are living. Focus on that. Just focus on that. Because let me tell you what's happened. They've had a restoration of their moral imagination in that moment. And just one little seed of being hopeful showed that person, when they were able to audibilize that to you, oh, well, maybe I do have a reason to live. And it only takes one reason to live when you're thinking about dying to stay here. You know what I mean? And that's so important. It's so important. Some people say, well, that's just, you know, that's not big. They were just able to say one thing. Well, that's really big when the next movement was going to be blowing their brains out with a firearm. It's super big, right? And so moral injury is a violation of what's right to you. And it doesn't matter what that is. If it's right to you and it's been broken to the sense of, man, this is really making me question my worth, my existence. The things that are fractured around moral injury are trust, competence, autonomy, right? Identity. And so when you can step in into a conversation, into someone's life in such a way, and you can help them reframe what that looks like. Because remember, I said healing isn't forgetting, it's remembering differently, okay? Mm-hmm. So when you can remember what's worth living when all you've been thinking about are reasons to die, that's huge.
That's huge. Dr. Carter, can we go back a little bit to the beginning of the episode where we were talking about the signals that people ignore? Can we talk a little bit about the warning signs? And when you're saying, what are the signals that people are typically overriding? And what does that look like physically, in relationships, spiritually, or emotionally?
Yeah, great question. The body is usually the first thing to speak. So sleep disruption, chronic tension, a low-grade irritability that has no specific cause, right? You're just irritated. People treat those as logistics problems, but they adjust the sleep routine or take something for the tension and then just keep moving. Well, I'll take some melatonin, or I'll take some gummies, or whatever that looks like, right? And they just keep moving. Then there's the relational signals, increasing distance from people who matter, right? That isolation I was talking about. Conversations that tend to stay on the surface, even when you want them to go deeper. There's that sense that you're performing a version of yourself rather than actually being present with people. Then you've got the conscience, right? And this is that layer of, you know, people are like, well, where does moral injury live? It lives in the conscience, right? Moral health is about the conscience. Mental health is about the psychological, right? So the conscience, the quiet awareness that something you're doing or tolerating or even believing no longer lines up with who you understand yourself to be. That one tends to arrive last, but stay the longest.
Right. Why do you think people tend to get busier when they start feeling uncomfortable? Why does busyness become a coping mechanism?
I think people tend to want to avoid, right? And so busyness is an avoidance tool, just like isolation. Not all isolation is bad, but when isolation turns into an avoidance tool, it's the same. It becomes debilitating. It becomes something that's not good for you. So I think at the end of the day, it's about avoidance. It's about avoidance of not having the tough conversation, not having the tough realization of where you are.
Yeah, absolutely. What are the costs of ignoring these signals that are happening? What are the consequences?
Look, well, I think the ultimate cost is getting to the place where you don't feel like you should exist. I think that's the ultimate. That's the ultimate cost. Relationships, which should be a part of your life that should be a pillar of strength, not, you know, so you start to lose relationships because you don't connect. You don't, yeah, you're not being authentic. And people, you know, people see that. I know in your own life, when people have been intentionally unauthentic, you're like, okay, what's up with this person, right? And that causes you to not just avoid, it causes you to be avoided by other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so true. And it definitely affects people's sense of purpose. I feel like when you're going through that and you're not quite, like you said, they're incoherent, people don't know where they belong in the world. And I think that's one of the scariest places someone can be, is that feeling of belonging. And you talked about purpose, having the reason to wake up in the morning.
Yeah. You know, here's one of the things that I think why service dogs are so important for veterans. They give them a reason to move. They give them a reason to get off the couch. A lot of times it's that relationship alone that keeps some veterans alive. You know, and people will be like, oh, it's just a pet. Not to them. Look, I don't know if you're someone that likes fur babies. I've got a couple in my house, and I would say that, you know, they're more my wife's dogs and my daughter's dogs than my dogs. But even in times of, you know, loneliness or avoidance, or, you know, I'd love to sit here and say I never have a bad day, but I have them too, right? Everyone has problems. Let's just throw that one out there. And the only reason you don't have problems is because you haven't lived long enough to have any. But you show me someone who has purpose in their life. You used that word a second ago. And I'll show you someone who has the ability to walk through and around and even over problems almost like they don't exist. Mm-hmm. But you show me someone that has no purpose in their life, and I'll show you someone who is high risk for suicide. They're thinking more about why they shouldn't be in the world than why they should be in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so true. You work with a lot of veterans and first responders, and most veterans and first responders are trained to essentially push through pain. So that strength then is actually part of the problem. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. I think that's where healthy resilience crosses sometimes into something damaging. Mm-hmm. When it's no longer resilience. See, resilience is the capacity to move through difficulty without losing yourself in it. And what I often see is endurance without direction. So people who've learned to absorb enormous amounts of pressure without ever asking what the pressure is doing to them.
Right.
Resilience restores you, but endurance without reflection just delays the cost. And the cost tends to arrive at the worst possible moment because you keep adding to the load without ever putting anything down. That's the danger of high performers.
Right. And then let's talk about the wake-up call. What finally gets through to someone who's been ignoring the signals for a long time? Like, what usually happens in order to essentially wake someone up?
You know, this is the really sad part, because it normally takes something extreme.
Mm-hmm. So true.
Like a death experience, usually something you cannot override, right? A health crisis, a car accident, a relationship that ends, right? a moment where the performance fails publicly and there's absolutely nothing left to hide behind.
Right.
Or sometimes quietly, someone who sees past the competence and asks the right question at the right moment. I call those people 2 a.m. friends. I'm glad I have them in my life because, you know, I don't know about you, but I'm one of those people. I've got a couple of therapists, okay? One that I have to talk with, and, you know, a lot of the things that I do in my day job are not, it's not shop talk. It's not like I'd be hanging around with my normal everyday friends and telling them about people who are suicidal or attempting to blow their brains out or hanging in a tree or any of those types of things, right? That's not genuinely what you bring into a conversation with your friend or a spouse or a you know, someone you're intimate with. So you got to carry those burdens on your own. So I have a couple of therapists where I can process some of those things, right? And I always say this, I need a therapist who has a high BS meter because I know all the right things to say. You know, if I'm trying to be avoidant or not be vulnerable, because yes, I can do that too. I know exactly how to say the right things and navigate those types of conversations without having the hard ones. But I'm glad that the people that I work with understand the difference between carefrontation and confrontation and their ability to say, Carter, I hear you, but what about this, right? And what I've learned is that the signal is usually always there with someone, and the people who know you the best usually know. And there's a lot of times when you see it in people, you know, too, they're just waiting for permission to stop pretending that they're pretending.
I think one of the quieter ways that change can happen is in a moment of vulnerability where someone feels like they can finally speak it out loud. I know that's happened for me where I'm really struggling and I've said it out loud. And as soon as I say it out loud, it's like, okay, now I can't ignore this anymore because it becomes real. It's there. It's out in the open. Now somebody else knows. I think that's the difference between not speaking our truth and speaking our truth. Because as soon as we speak it out loud and another human is aware of it, there's a sense of responsibility there. There's a sense of that we need to now face it or change. And if we don't, then it's almost like we don't want to be around that human anymore because we're ashamed that we're not doing anything about it. Because they
there's
know
shame again. Yep. You know, the common connector of all traumatic experiences is loss. And one of the ways that we really navigate the conversation around moral injury is we come at it through the lens of loss, not examining exactly what happened in your experience. Because a lot of times when you do that, Lisa, you get too much into the why did this happen, right? And you never step into how. People get stuck in the why and never get into the how. What do you mean by how? Like, how am I going to survive this? How am I going to walk through this? If you're constantly focused on why, you can't step into how. But once you step over into the how, then you can do something which I think is so important. It is the most important thing when you've experienced loss. You have got to have a recognition of what did you lose. Recognition is the first step in recovering from loss. Because if you don't recognize where you're at, how are you going to move? How are you going to have a step forward in any direction, right? And a lot of times what we want to do when we've experienced significant loss is we want to try and build a bridge over the pain, but you got to go through the pain. You can't build a bridge over the pain. If you try to, you're just going to come right back. You're going to cycle right back to that pain, and usually it's going to happen in a time that's not on your timetable. You know, at least if I go to the pain, I'm doing it on my own. I'm being intentional about it.
Right.
The worst part is when you're avoiding it and then pain shows up on its timetable, not on yours. Then it can show up whenever it wants. And usually it shows up at the wrong time.
On purpose. it's such a blessing though, you know, those moments where it shows up, it's meant to propel us forward. And it's not easiest to recognize in the moment. We don't see it that way. But when you look back on those situations, it was like a blessing, because it allowed for change to happen. But unfortunately, sometimes it's too late, which is the sad part.
Yeah, especially around suicide, right? Because once you've made that ultimate decision, you're out of the game, right? I sit in front of a lot of people that are in that lane of trying to determine whether life is worth living, and I often say, think about this. It doesn't matter the hell you've been through. Right now, right in this moment, you're operating at 100% success rate of being here. Now, I don't know what else you operate at 100% at, but that's a pretty good one. So let's keep that going, because the reality is this. As long as you're here, you get to write how your story ends. But when you check out and you give that up, somebody else writes how your story ends. I really do think, Lisa, I really do think people that ultimately make the decision to take their life, I really feel like most of them, outside of a murder suicide, right? Somebody that takes a life and then takes their own life. I think most people who die by suicide feel like they're jumping on a grenade to save everybody else that's around them. Like they feel like they're such a burden to the people who are around them that by taking themselves out, that they're relieving them of that burden. But what they don't realize is they are handing a burden over to those that are left that's 100 times, maybe 1,000 times heavier than what they thought they were taking from them. I see that all the time. And so, you know, if anybody's watching this and you're thinking, man, everybody would just be better if I just took myself out, do not believe that. Suicide survivors, those that are left after you decide to take your life. So if you take your life, the kids you leave, the spouse you leave, the siblings you leave, they're 175% more likely to die by suicide themselves. The lie is, the lie that you might be listening to is telling you the world would be better without you. I promise you right now, if you feel that way, why don't you go ask the world? Why don't you go ask the people that you're thinking about your unburdening? Go ask them if they would rather you be gone or here. And I promise you, you're going to hear a completely different story than what's happened in your mind. Because you remember we were talking about that moral imagination? There's something else that happens when people suffer moral injury. It's not that their imagination fractures and it doesn't work anymore. What happens, Lisa, is the fastest, hardest interpretation of the worst sense of themselves starts to loop in their mind. I'm the worst. I'm the worst husband. I'm the worst boyfriend. I'm the worst father. I'm the worst sibling. I'm the worst spouse. I'm a terrible wife. It does, whatever that is. And it runs over time. And so when we have that ability to step in and interrupt that negative loop, then that restoration of imagination is even more important, because now we've interrupted that loop of the worst interpretation that they have of themselves. And they start to see, well, no. Yeah, I am this. I am worth living. I'm going to live. And it's like, you know, I don't know about you. I love to laugh. I think laughter, like a good gut laugh, might be better than the best antibiotic shot I've ever had in my life. Okay.
Totally. Yeah.
But when you encounter some people who have been so depressed and so disconnected from joy in their life, that they haven't laughed in years. It's like experiencing that when you have that interruption of that negative loop. It's like not laughing. I don't even know what it would be like to not laugh for a year, let alone a couple of days. But there's people out there that they haven't enjoyed that sense of like laughter. And I just want to, and I just hope that they just gut laugh like they've never laughed in their entire life. Because, you know, even scripture says laughter is like a medicine. And I believe that. I believe that. Even if you don't believe what scripture, you know, or scripture, hey, laughter is like a medicine, because you can be in the worst spot. You know, sometimes my wife and I will be disagreeing or in an argument, and I'll do something that's funny and she'll start laughing and we've forgotten what we were angry about.
Yeah.
There's something powerful about laughter.
There's something so powerful about laughter. I agree. What about the people out there who are struggling really, really terribly with their mental health? And so there are people who are, they wake up anxious. You just mentioned the depression. How do you suggest they get a grip on life and their life purpose and wanting to live? I know that can be so difficult. I've had seasons of anxiety and depression myself where it's been really, really challenging to leave my space at times. That's a tough one for me, because that person is struggling so much. They don't want to be here because they can't handle life.
Yeah. Look, I think it's a first honest step. Like, you have to be honest with yourself. And remember, we were talking about recognition. If you don't ever find where you're bleeding from, it's really hard to stop the bleeding. So you have to have that first honest step, right? So name what you've been ignoring. Not to someone else necessarily, maybe not yet, but just to yourself, and say it plainly. Something is wrong. I have to know it. And I've known it, but I gotta say it. I've been overriding it. And just that acknowledgement, just being honest, unembellished, is more powerful than most people expect. Because you can't heal what you keep mislabeling or you keep missing. But the moment you name it accurately, something shifts. Not everything, but your posture. And the posture is so important, because you stop managing the wound and you start facing it. That is the number one first step. If you're suffering, name it. And then the next step, tell somebody. I'm struggling. Mm-hmm. Find somebody. Look, if you're out there and you can't find anybody, there's a national crisis hotline. Dial 988 and you're going to get a crisis counselor to you. And if you're a veteran, dial 988 and press 1, and it'll take you directly to the National Crisis Line for Veterans with the Department of Veteran Affairs. And look, you don't have to be the veteran. You can be with a veteran and call that number. I don't know about you. I have 988 in my phone. I've got it on the ready every time, because, look, the reason we have medical kits is not because we want to use them. It's because if we need one, it's good to have one, right? Yeah. And so if you're out there and you're around anybody on a daily basis doing any type of care, make sure those National Crisis Line numbers are saved in your phone. Because the one thing is for sure, if you need it, you're going to want to know that it's there on the dial, that you can get it quick. Yeah,
that's a great point. Thank you for saying that. That's so important. So important. If someone listening right now knows they've been ignoring the signal, what do you want them to hear most today?
I want you to hear that the signal you've been ignoring is not a sign of weakness. It's a sign of conscience, and it means something in you still knows what matters. The fact that you feel it, even if you've been pushing it down, means you haven't gone numb. And that is where healing begins, not in the fix, but in the honest acknowledgement that something needs attention. So don't think because you've been ignoring it that you're weak. You recognize it. Now just go after it.
And what about to the person who's exhausted from pretending everything is fine? What would you say to them?
Hey, quit pretending. I know that sounds really simple, but if you've listened to any of my stuff at all, you know that I'm the author of Healing in the Wild. It's my book that I wrote when I thought, what do I want to leave the universe if God forbid I was to be gone tomorrow. And it was my model of self-care, because there's been moments in my life when I needed someone to show up and they didn't. And you know what always shows up? Nature always shows up. As long as you show up, nature shows up. And let me tell you what happens in nature. Whether it's a sunrise or a sunset, or you're sitting in the woods, or you're bird watching, or you're collecting mushrooms, or whatever you like to do, rock climbing, hiking, bird watching, you slow down. You start to pay attention. You start to pay attention to what's around you. You recognize that there are things going on that if you'll just slow down for a second, you'll catch up. And so I think that's what I would want to leave with people today. If you're having trouble finding people to show up, go experience nature. Go on a hike. Go put your feet in like good grass, barefoot, you know? Typically not wet grass, unless that's what you like. But, you know, go find a good lawn. Take your shoes off. Close your eyes. Breathe. Just breathe. Take deep breaths. Experience what's happening around you and try to quiet what's happening inside of you. Because what's happening inside of you, it's not that it's not loud or has the ability to. But if you can spend 30 seconds or a minute recognizing that that stuff doesn't control you, then you'll realize that you have the ability to overcome some of those things. Like they don't control you. Your emotions are trying to tell you that those things have you, but they don't. You have them. Take back your authority.
Yeah, and nature is so perfectly imperfect. Like you go, or even planting a garden, you plant a seed and it takes a long time for that seed to bloom. And so that's another thing I think that people need to understand, is that like healing takes a lot of time. But one day you're going to be walking in the forest or through your garden, and you're going to see this beautiful flower. And that's exactly what's going to happen to you if you feed yourself, fill your own cup, and do those things. Acknowledge something isn't right. And just those little things every day make the biggest difference.
Yeah, they do. You're exactly right about that. Fill your cup, like you said. Find the small things. And look, sometimes you got to stack wins. I think we always look for like these huge wins to go after, but just small wins consistently over a short period of time turn into big wins. So take every win that you can, right? Win.
Totally. Thank you so much for being here and having this important conversation. Can you tell everyone a little bit more about the work that you do, especially for the people who might have missed the last episodes?
Yeah. So I'm a healthcare ethicist and a clinical chaplain with the Department of Veteran Affairs. So the majority of my work is centered around veterans and first responder community, high performers. I'm an Army vet myself. And a lot of what I talk about doesn't come from academics or knowledge. It comes from needing help in an area that I was suffering. And when I went to the VA, it didn't exist. So that pushed me like fire into a gap of care where I started to talk about moral health and moral injury, because people were trying to tell me I was suffering from post-traumatic stress. And that's not what I was dealing with. I wasn't dealing with a fear-based, you know, a condition of being scared of dying. Right. What I was dealing with was a violation of what was right to me. I'd experienced a betrayal in service. And that pushed me into master's degrees and doctoral degrees and writing books and being a professor at Oral Roberts University now in the area of moral health and moral injury. And so what I'd love to say is my scars, not my wounds, but my scars have become a pathway for me to connect with other people who are suffering. And so I'm a peer-reviewed author and publications around things that deal with clinical chaplaincy and moral injury, and created some workbooks and continue to do that because I have a passion. I really feel like all the statistical data that we have around suicide death is what leads to death. You know, all the data that we have, Lisa, comes from the CDC. It's 2 years old. So the present data that we have around suicidality is 2 years old. And then next year, it'll still be 2 years old. But all that data is what leads to someone taking their life. None of that data shows us why people would continue to live. My pursuit academically, my dad always jokes and says I have more degrees than a thermometer. I pursued a research degree to be a healthcare ethicist, and so a PhD in healthcare ethics, because I wanted that research degree because I want to go after the data from the person that wanted to kill themselves that decided not to. Why didn't you? I think that data is far more important. Now, listen, doesn't mean the data that we get isn't important. It is, okay? But we need the data that shows why people continue to live as well. I think it's just as important. And it's just not out there. It's just not out there. People haven't put in the time to go after that data. Well, that's something that I'm passionate about and pursuing in my work around veteran care and first responder care. And so I want to see people live. And I'm passionate about saving lives. And I know I can't save them all. And I know I'll never be able to stop suicidality 100%. But here's what I can promise you is I'll do everything in my power and in my strength to reach as many as I can along the way.
Such important work that you're doing, and I love how you flip the script. Instead of what is causing people to leave the planet, what is causing people to stay? I think that's so important, and such an important distinction between the two. Where can people find you?
Yeah, great question. So drcartercheck.com. You can go to my website and you can find out all the things about me. Healinginthewild.com too, if you want to check out Healing in the Wild. It's on almost every platform that you can think of, the audio book. You can go to Amazon and get it. And just a little teaser, we're going to be doing some more podcasts later this month on a new book. On a new book that I've finished that's going to be coming out later this month. So I'm not going to say too much about that right now, but know that it's coming. And in like most things that I do, I really have a strong desire to meet people where they are without some predetermined journey of where I feel like they need to go. I want to be a source of strength. I want people to be the expert of their own life. And that's usually how you're going to encounter me. Is going to be like walking down to the creek, having a conversation. I'm not prescriptive and I'm not advisory. What I will do is use the tools that the good Lord has given me to pull out of you what's already within you for you to be the best resource in your own life.
Absolutely. Well, thank you again, Dr. Carter, for being here today and for having such an important conversation. So impactful. And again, thank you for the work that you're doing.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you to our audience for tuning in today. I think so many people listening today will recognize themselves somewhere in this story. The warning signs are rarely the problem. The problem is believing we have to keep pushing through them. So, if you'd like to learn more about Dr. Carter Czech and his work, his book, Healing in the Wild, or the programs he's created to help people heal and reconnect with themselves, all of his information will be available in the show notes. And if this episode resonated with you, share it with someone who might need to hear it. Thank you so much for joining us. I think my key takeaway is that the signal that we've been ignoring, it isn't a weakness. So this is actually information, and listening to it might be the beginning of your healing journey. So stay tuned for the next episode. Take care, everyone.